All right, so hear me out now, but rising prices in this economy are not necessarily a terrible thing. A brief discourse on inflation today. Also, more of our series, The United States of Work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 19th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know that we go round and round about inflation on this program. Sometimes it's up a tad, sometimes it's stuck. That is just kind of the way the economic ball bounces. But we got a read on inflation today, something called the PPI, the Producer Price Index, which is inflation at the wholesale level that is worth spending a couple of minutes on. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
These new numbers surprised a lot of experts, up 0.5% in January.
So that may not sound like a lot, but for a monthly number, that is quite a bit.
Richard Weiss is a senior vice president at American Century Investments. It was the biggest jump in this measure of inflation in more than a year.
If you start to see producer prices rise, you can almost assuredly count on consumer prices rising down the road.
Much of the bump came from services, not goods. Part of that was higher health care prices because of changes to Medicare rules. Robin Anderson, a senior economist at Principal Global Investors, says even if the spike is a one-off, January's numbers reflect a long-term trend.
What you do see is a difference between what's going on in services inflation and what's going on with goods inflation. Goods inflation has been pretty weak for a while.
And what's happening with services gives us a hint as to what's ahead for other inflation measures. Tony Rodriguez is head of fixed income strategy at investment firm Nuveen.
Today's PPI numbers, along with some of the other inflation data that we've been seeing, just increases our confidence that we will move in the direction that we've been expecting.
Getting closer to the Fed's 2% target, just slowly.
Emphasis on capital letter slowly.
And it will take another few months of data before most economists are convinced inflation's really on the rise. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, PPI was one economic data point today. Real estate provided us with a couple of others. We learned this morning that housing starts were off more than 3.5% in January from a month earlier. But the number of permits issued to begin building new homes, the thing you got to get before you get housing starts, were up. Now, a monthly report does not valid analysis make, but when you look at the housing trend over, I don't know, say the past year, housing starts are up almost 20%. We have all heard about the affordable housing crisis, right? Especially for first-time would-be buyers. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman got to wondering today whether now we are finally getting more supply to meet that housing demand. Here's Mitchell.
I talked to Philip McCoy on the phone today as he was sitting in the back seat of his realtor's car. He and his wife were driving around Richmond, Virginia, looking at houses. They've got two kids. They're moving from Pittsburgh for Philip to work as an ER doctor. Some houses they wanted to see were already sold.
They were just flying off the market, it seemed like, and so it was just stressing us out.
Now, the recent surge in new home construction could be good for them, especially since a lot of it's being built in the South. Except, says Zillow economist Jeff Tucker,
the median price for a new home in 2019 was $320,000.
And Philip McCoy says new homes are out of their price range.
There is apparently a lot of new construction, but I think we're just not able to quite afford that.
The median price of an existing home in the U.S. is around $245,000. So Jeff Tucker says pricier new construction doesn't hurt.
That can still help affordability nationwide because a lot of the people buying those homes are moving up from, you know, their own starter home that they're turning around and putting back on the market.
And there are plenty of buyers for those homes, says Joel Kahn at the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Over the last 3 years, we have seen more sustained household growth, and I think that's the coming of age of younger potential homeowners.
That's millennials moving up in careers, earning more, and gradually able to pay more for a starter home. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. About all you need to know is that the Fed is planning to keep interest rates right where they are for a while. And that, it turns out, was enough for Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've got a question that we are asking and answering on the show the next couple of weeks, all the rest of the year as well, actually. Who are the people who make this economy work, and is this economy working for them? This is the United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has your ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
That's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
Our stop today is the service economy. It's about 17% of the labor force, 2 out of 10 workers, plus or minus. Jobs like medical assistants and police officers, lifeguards and chefs and dishwashers. Remember, our literary device here was to create 10 profiles representing as closely as possible the characteristics of the 164 million people in the entire American labor force. And then to go out and find those people. Details and methodology at marketplace.org/work. But right now, our two service sector workers, same sector of this economy, very different backgrounds, though, very different jobs and very different economic realities.
My name is Neil, and I'm a bartender at the Game Night Lounge here in Portland.
34-year-old Neil Cairns in Portland, Oregon.
We're a board game bar, so we specialize in board games. We have over 850 board games there. We get lots of families in, couples, big groups, that kind of thing. But yeah, the place is a blast.
Do you have to know the rules of all these games, or you just like let other people?
No, I usually tell people I know somewhere between 5 and 7% of the games. I know where most of them are on the shelves, and I feel like I'm doing pretty good there.
What got you into bartending anyway?
Oh, I got out of the Navy and wanted to do something totally different. You know, took a 2-week course to learn how to tend bar, and then just started applying places, and it turned out something I really love doing.
What did you do in the service? What did you do in the Navy?
I was a linguist, so I was a Spanish translator, basically.
How long were you in?
About 9 years. 8 years, 11 months, and 18 days, specifically.
But who's counting?
Yeah, I wasn't keeping track or anything.
Yeah. So I will tell you, I spent 8 years in the military, Navy as well. And the big challenge for me when I was done was figuring out what I was going to do when I got out. Mm. How did that go for you?
About the same. I didn't have a big plan in place and, started looking for things that I could potentially do. My skill set was not vast. I could speak Spanish and I was living in San Antonio, so everyone else did too. And so I needed to find some skill that I could pick up in a relatively short period of time and get to work.
Hmm. Can we back up for a minute? Why did you join the military right out of high school? What was it that, that drove that?
Panic, I think. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. Nobody had ever really talked to me about things like how to apply to a college or apply to take my SATs or ACTs. So I hadn't done any of that. You know, I did not come from a well-off family. So they definitely could not have paid for my school. I tried thinking of what my best options was going to be. And I did know where the military recruiters were. So I went that way.
So you get out and you wind up as a bartender. What's your day like? I mean, you get up in the morning, or I imagine you're tending bar till late at night. So you get up probably mid-morning, late morning.
I wake up at the crack of noon and, usually grab breakfast at home and then hop on the bus. Need to be worked at 3:30. I'm, Navy man, tend to show up everywhere early. So I'm usually there, no later than 3:00. But it takes me between an hour and a half to get to work every day. I commute on the bus and with my bike. But then, work the bar until close, clean the place up, rush to get back to a bus and train to make it back home before the train stop running, and head to bed and do it again the next day.
Are you making a good living? I mean, are you getting by?
I'm getting by. It's a week-to-week kind of thing. This is one of the lower volume places I've worked, so I do make a little bit less than I have at other bars. I'm able to pay the bills and pay my debt, and that's about it.
So all in all, then, is this economy working out for you?
I'd say it's definitely a challenge. When I started tending bar back in 2012 and in the year or so that followed, I made really good money. I made money enough that I was able to save. When I decided to move back to Oregon, I saved $3,000 in 3 months to make the move. These days, I don't think I could do anything even similar. without living a pretty pauper lifestyle.
So if this bar closed tomorrow, what would you do? Would you be all right?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Think about that every now and then. I don't know exactly what I would do. I think the first thing I would probably do right now would be able to apply to some of the places much closer to my house. I live within walking distance of three bars. But bartending here in Portland is a really competitive market. I tell people all the time we have over 900 bars in Portland, which is a lot, but we have about 12 bartenders for every bar. And you don't need that many. So the competition to get a bartending job is pretty stiff.
Hmm. Last thing, what's your least favorite drink to have to make at the bar?
Oh, man. It's going to be either a Long Island iced tea.
Oh, yeah.
Or any layered shot. Really not a fan of making those things.
That was Neil Cairns, barkeep at the Game Night Lounge in Portland, Oregon. Later on in the program,
when people say, like, oh, it's just hair, I'm like,
The Service Economy, Part 2. Yes, I know it's almost March, but the gears of retail capitalism grind slowly, you know, which is why we are still getting updates on the holiday season. One thing we're learning amid a slew of corporate profit reports coming out the past couple of days is that parents just aren't buying their kids as many toys as they used to. Walmart reported earnings yesterday, toy sales disappointed. Target said the same thing just the other day. And big picture, the market research firm MPD Group says toy sales were off 4% last year. Marketplace's Mario Segarra looks at that slowdown.
There's something torturing Andrew Fleischman. It's a green talking dinosaur, a toy that a family friend gave to his 4-year-old daughter, Jane. You feed it these little plastic discs in the shape of food. It likes to turn on for no apparent reason at 2 a.m.
And it demands to be fed. It says, can you feed me? It's not enough to just put something in the dinosaur. It's like a specific food. It's got to be like the apple.
Fleischman and his wife, Julia, live in a small 2-bedroom house in Atlanta with their 6-month-old son, Colin, and Jane.
And we're constantly begging friends and relatives not to buy our toys.
I put a call out on Twitter today asking parents about their toy buying habits. Dozens of you responded, thanks by the way, and said you're buying fewer toys or none at all. You're tired of the clutter. You'd rather your kids have experiences, or you're worried about the environment. So those are some reasons toy sales are down. There are others, too. Walmart CEO pointed out that there was no must-have toy this past holiday season. James Zahn is senior editor at the Toy Insider.
We haven't had in the last few years, actually, a hot toy that transcends all, that every boy and girl has to have.
You know, the Hatchimal or Tickle Me Elmo. And Steve Peserb, CEO of the Toy Association, says retailers rely on that hot toy to drive overall sales.
That gets people into stores, into the toy aisle, where they discover other things. So in years where you don't have that, it really does make a difference.
Walmart CEO also said the most popular toys this year were cheap. So that hurt the sales numbers, too. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And I decided that someday I would live in a log home.
And live in a log home she does. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 115 points today, 0.4%, 29,348 at the close for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 84 points, 0.8%, 98.17. The S&P 500 banked 15 points, 0.4%, 33.86. So, just talk about toys. Yeah, here you go. Mattel, maker of Barbie dolls, among other things, down 1.7% today. Hasbro, it of Monopoly and Play-Doh fame, gained 0.2%. Walmart, the biggest toy retailer in the country, down 1.6% on the day. Bonds flat. Yield on the 10-year Treasury notes, 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We were up in Portland, Oregon earlier talking to Neil Cairns for our series, The United States of Work. 164 million people in the American labor force. We are telling the stories of a representative 10. Neil tends bar, you remember, and works in a game club. He is one of the two people in our reimagining of the labor force, representing the 20% of us who work in the service economy. But not all service jobs are the same. Right. So draw a line 430 miles east on I-84 out of Portland over to Boise, Idaho.
So cold, I could barely open up my car door.
Where Ashley Nelson, she is also 34, by the way, same as Neil, has lived the past 14 years. How'd you wind up in Idaho?
It's actually kind of funny because people ask me that all the time, and I'm actually from California, and I moved out to Idaho for hair school, actually, because my dad lived out here. Hair school was about $10,000 cheaper here than in San Francisco. Couldn't pay my rent 1 month, and so my dad made me.
Wow. How much does hair school cost?
I think right now it's like $20,000, but it was $20,000 like 14 years ago in San Francisco, and it was like $10,000 in Boise.
So, Boise it was. Ashley enrolled in cosmetology school, and then, well, then she started cutting people's hair. Were you terrified?
Oh, terrified is almost an understatement for me because I'm now a recovering perfectionist, but at the time I was a perfectionist, and it was like so detrimental to my career in the beginning because I was so scared to mess up anyone's hair. When people say like, oh, it's just hair, I'm like, but it's on your head and it's the first thing that everyone sees.
How'd you get over that?
Continuing to show up.
Yeah.
Just trying over and over again, thinking, honestly, God, that people kept showing up. Because I probably did a lot of bad haircuts and colors out there.
And you apologize for them, I suppose.
Well, right? Boise's small, so it'd be interesting to be like at a restaurant and you look over and you're like, why does that person look familiar? And you're like, oh, man, I gave that person a bad haircut a long time ago.
Many long hours on her feet, and 14 years later, she's got a thriving business. She takes home more than $100,000 a year. She's got clients she likes, a car that's paid off, and a house she bought with her husband a couple of years ago in a neighborhood she loves. Basically, the flip side of what Neil the bartender is living. Same service economy, different lives. So what does a typical day look like for you? I mean, what time do you show up at the salon, and how does that work?
I start between 6 and 8, but usually
in the morning?
I have a lot of clients.
People come at 6 in the morning for a haircut?
Yeah, I have a lot of clients that like that time. I even have clients like, oh, I start at 5:30 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah, I actually joke that I call my C-class clients. My CFOs, CEOs, moms with like high powered jobs that like have to just basically get in before their day.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, not to get all technical, but you are smack in the middle of the service economy, right? I mean, there's not much more that's service oriented than, you know, taking care of somebody's hair.
Yeah, it's interesting because as I built my career, I watched a lot of people work, you know, the hours from, you know, like 10 to 6. Mm-hmm. Well, 10 to 6 is when people are at work. You aren't really going to get, like, the type of clients that I was looking for during those hours. But
yeah, so who were you looking for, client-wise?
I guess people who can, like, value my services, you know? I feel like my whole clientele has grown off of me just being patient.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to sit for 50 hours a week at a salon and sometimes make, like, oh, my gosh, like $200 in a week. Now it's like, I mean, I'm having to tell myself I can't work 14-hour days. So my days are very long, very, very long.
Are you able to raise your prices? I mean, is it that good? Is it that busy?
Yeah. I mean, Idaho's growing so much. So especially like where I live, Idaho just is like bringing in all of California, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it's booming. I mean, I was thinking the other day, I started this client out maybe 10 years ago. She started at like $115 when she first started coming to me, and she closes out now at $200. Yeah.
It cost her $115 to get a haircut, and now it costs her $200?
That was for a cut and color, like when I first started, yeah.
Gotcha. Is this what you wanted to do when you were a kid?
Yeah, it was actually. I remember wrapping fake perms on my grandma and telling my dad I wanted to do hair, and he told me, well, you'll always have a job, because no matter how broke people are, people will always come get their hair done, because it'll make them feel good. And I think he was right, because in 08, that was like when I was building, and it was weird to have people handing over cash to you and being like, oh, this is my bill money, and you're like, oh.
Wow.
Like, you just felt bad. I'm like, oh, you're paying my bills now, so.
Wow. Yeah. There is a side of you that has to be a straight-ahead business person, right? You have to keep your books. You have to crunch the numbers, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because that's the part that I don't think anyone realizes. And so if you're really good artistically and really good with people, but you suck at that, you're going to really fail. I mean, when I was in hair school, they said 90% of the people you're going to hair school with right now will not be doing hair in 5 years.
Wow.
And it's just wild because now when I look back, I'm like, man, there aren't a lot of those people doing hair still.
But she is making a go of it in the service economy. On the program tomorrow...
Nobody makes $1 million working in an independent film house.
The movie business in the Music City, Nashville, Tennessee, and the fourth member of our 10-person labor force. You can check out all 10 of them right now and dig into the data and our methodology at marketplace.org/work. Mitchell was talking to housing up the top of the program, right? And how over the past year or so, we have been building more than we have in a while. The modern era being what it is, though, most of us aren't all that intimately involved in the construction of the homes we live in, or honestly, even how they were built. But for today's installment of our series, Adventures in Housing, the story of a new home built the old way.
My name's Bridget Ruthman. I live in the Berkshire Mountains in Western Massachusetts. When I was young, my family owned a log cabin in the Laurentians in Quebec. It was a ski house. We would spend our vacations there, and these were massive logs, maybe a foot by a foot in square diameter, that had cracks with little secrets in them. We once found a note in one of the cracks. And I thought, this is so much better than living in a perfectly square room. It has a feel to it. It's like living within artwork. And I decided that someday I would live in a log home. In 1996, I followed an ad in the paper that said 12 and a half acres for sale for $5,500. And I thought there must be a zero missing. And I went up with the realtor and I looked at this piece of land that was three telephone poles off the grid, and I bought it. I cleared it for several years. I spent all of my vacation time clearing the land and was able to get back to a sense of where a house belonged on that land and how I would configure a small farm. 2004, I got a log cabin kit. I enlisted a couple of my friends and my reluctant brothers, and we together kind of just went about the task of building a log home, not having ever done it before. Thereafter, I became my own contractor. Anytime you build a house, it doesn't really matter if it's a cabin or a house. The first thing you need is a driveway. Then you need a septic system. And then you need a well. We dug down 310 feet.
Then you need to hire the subcontractors. And
you can't begin out of plumbing. They need to be paid on a certain foundation. Roofing needs to be ordered. It takes 2 months. We fit the logs together, and that took a little doing. I do remember the first night I spent in that home. I was so happy to be sleeping in a place that I built. I felt that I belonged. If somebody had told me how difficult it is to build a house, I might have given it pause. But the alternative was to live in somebody else's house or an apartment. In the end, it all seems to be worth it. When I look up in the morning, I remember which logs I placed, how heavy they were. I've scribbled little notes all over the logs. If somebody takes them apart in 100 or 200 years, they'll see what I left behind.
That's Bridget Ruthman, living in a log house in Western Massachusetts. Do us a favor, would you tell us about your adventures in housing, log or otherwise? You can do it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, maybe you saw this when it came out a couple of days ago. I just happened on it yesterday. Kind of an amazing statistic from Netflix's first ESG report. That stands for Environmental Social Governance. In 2019, the streaming company's total electricity use was 451,000 megawatt hours. In layman's terms, that's enough to power 40,000 homes for a year. The company does say It invests in renewable energy and carbon offsets, but still, 2019 energy use at Netflix was an 84% jump from a year earlier. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 115 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 84, 0.8%. The S&P 500, 15 points to the good, 0.4% there as well. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.